it's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos, maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Rico Bronya's presented by FanDuel Sportsbook. Make every moment more.
Tito's Handmade Vodka is America's favorite vodka for a reason. From the first legal distillery in Texas, Tito's is six times distilled till it's just right. And naturally gluten-free, making it a high-quality spirit that mixes with just about anything. From the smoothest martinis to the best Bloody Marys. Tito's is known for giving back, teaming up with nonprofits to serve its communities and do good for dogs. Make your next cocktail with Tito's. Distilled and bottled by Fifth Generation Inc., Austin, Texas. 40% alcohol by volume. Savor responsibly.
At Blinds.com, it's not just about window treatments. It's about you, your style, your space, your way. Whether you DIY or want the pros to handle it all, you'll have the confidence of knowing it's done right. From free expert design help to our 100% satisfaction guarantee, everything we do is made to fit your life and your windows. Because at Blinds.com, the only thing we treat better than windows is you. Visit Blinds.com now for up to 45% off with minimum purchase, plus a professional measure at no cost. Rules and restrictions apply.
It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
It is indeed a brand new edition of The Rico, affectionately known as Rico Bronya, episode 544. We got a lot to get to. The Mets lose 2 out of 3 to the Cincinnati Reds, but over the weekend we did lose a legend, so let's start there, and then we'll get into all the Mets stuff, what happened on Saturday, what happened on Sunday. These Rico Bronyas are therapy for me because I'm still steamed over what happened at MetLife Stadium with the Jets losing to the Pittsburgh Steelers. So the Rico is like a nice escape, even though I'm pissed about the Mets too. But it's like, let me channel my anger into a different place. But let's start off with what was the unfortunate news that hit us on Saturday, and that's the passing of Davey Johnson. Davey Johnson was, for a lot of us, like our first manager. Like for me growing up, learning about the Mets, my dad teaching me about the Mets, Davey Johnson was the manager. Gary Carter was the catcher. I didn't know much else. Like I was young, basically like what I'm teaching my 4 or 5 year old right now. And I remember growing up hearing the criticisms that my dad would lay out at Davey. But here's what I knew about Davey Johnson. I knew two things about Davey Johnson, just growing up as a youth, learning baseball. Two very important things. Number one, he managed the freaking team to a championship. So every other criticism that the current smart Met fan had in 1989 or 1988 when I was 5 and 6 years old that I did not fully understand, I also knew he had a pretty ring on his finger. And the other thing I learned very quickly about Davey was that he made the last out of the 1969 World Series. I always found that completely fascinating. And I know it's a coincidence and it doesn't mean much, but it taught me early that Davey wasn't just the manager of the New York Mets. He had a successful career, had that one major season in Atlanta where he hit over 40 home runs. So he was a hell of a ball player as a major leaguer long before I was even born. And then obviously grew up with the young Mets in the mid 80s when he was promoted from AAA to become the manager. And obviously the team had great success. And I think as we sit here today, that is the best era of New York Met baseball. The era between, well, let's call it the Davey Johnson era, because when they finally fired Davey and they went to Bud Harrelson, that didn't work out. So when you think of the mid-80s Mets, and obviously Daryl and Doc come to mind, Keith and Gary come to mind, you could call it the Davey Johnson era because he was the skipper. He was the leader during the best era of New York Met baseball. And then, you know, it's funny, I never got to have Davey Johnson as Met manager while understanding baseball. He was stories. Like I said, I was only 4, 5, 6 years old. I remember hearing the news about him being fired, but I didn't really understand it. And Buddy Harrelson replaced him. But then as I was learning baseball and watching baseball, Davey Johnson was an opponent. Remember him in Baltimore. Remember him in Cincinnati. How about even, I don't want to say recently, but it feels recently, managing the Nationals and being a part of shutting down Steven Strasburg, which Davey Johnson would later say, and this is not a surprise to anybody, not his idea and not something he wanted to do. So long after his great success with the Mets, obviously he put more pelts on that resume. The Dodgers too, if I'm not mistaken. But I certainly remember Cincinnati, Baltimore, Washington, a tremendous manager who one could argue is a Hall of Fame manager. But for us as Met fans, you cannot write the story of our history without prominently mentioning Davey Johnson. So rest in peace, Davey. Condolences to his family, to his wife, a great legacy that he had on the baseball field and off the baseball field. And like I mentioned, a huge, huge part of the franchise we love's history. As far as what happened on the field is concerned, we did a Rico right after Friday night's game. So if you want to hear good things and happiness, I would advise you to listen to episode 543 of the Rico Bronya when we go through all the amazing details of Edwin Diaz's Houdini act on Friday night. And thank goodness he pulled it off. I mean, thank goodness Edwin Diaz survived Friday night. Because it makes it just a tad bit, like a little bit easier when you look at what happened on Saturday and Sunday, that this wasn't a full-fledged disaster in being swept by the Cincinnati Reds. Can you imagine the tone we'd have right now? It'd be a four-game losing streak. It'd be being swept by the Cincinnati Reds. The lead over Cincinnati would be, I got to do some tricky math right now, because currently the lead is four. So I guess the lead would be two. And the Reds would have the tiebreaker. We would be in full panic city. So thank goodness for Edwin Diaz getting the job done on Friday. Look, here's how I would sum up what happened on Saturday and Sunday before we get into excruciating details. They didn't hit enough. Simple as that. An offense that has been really good for an extended period of time. On Saturday, I don't have any excuses. Saturday was missed opportunities. Saturday was Francisco Lindor getting way too into the stolen base, which is an issue around this team. They got to calm down. Like, they took advantage of teams having no idea early in the season that they're going to get that running lead, essentially. And Anton Richardson did an amazing job with this Met base running. And the Met base running has been a weapon. And I'm not saying it can't be a weapon as the season continues, but they got to pipe down. What happened on Saturday with Francisco Lindor, and Francisco had a great weekend, a very good weekend, and he will certainly be a candidate for the Rico I'm the Man Now Star of the Series. But some of the BS over-aggressiveness on the base paths have to stop. So when I think about Saturday's game, I think they didn't score enough runs. They only scored three runs. They couldn't hit Brady Singer, despite him giving them plenty of opportunities. And the Mets ran themselves out of innings. Lindor was caught stealing, and it was one of the caught stealings where it's not actually the catcher throwing you out, which the Mets went an incredibly long period of time of not having happen until Lindor broke it later in the game. But he leads off the first inning against Brady Singer with a base hit. You have Jonah Tong on the mound. Lindor is on base. You've got Soto. You got Nimmo. You got Alonso. I'm all for trying to be aggressive. But let's be smart about it. So Lindor aggressively, I think it was two pitches into the at-bat. It actually may have been one pitch into the at-bat. Takes off. Singer very calmly steps off the rubber, throws him out at second base. Boom. The inning's going nowhere. Going nowhere. Runs himself out of an inning. Okay, that happens, over-aggressiveness. The one that I would deem, unforgivable is a very strong term, the one I would deem like excruciatingly stupid was what happened in the fifth inning. So the Mets are now trailing in this game 4-1. We'll get into Tong's performance in a little bit. And Lindor rips a double. Ball that I thought was getting out. It was a screaming line drive, bounced off the fence. He picks up a one-out double with the Mets down by three runs. And Juan Soto coming up with one out. I'm all for nibbling. I'm all for cutting into that lead. If the Mets could walk away at 4-2, we'd feel better about it. I get that. But you have Juan Soto coming up. Juan Soto has been mashing with runners in scoring position. He has completely changed the script from earlier this season. If you're Francisco Lindor and you're on second base, not on first base, you're on second base, you can't steal third unless it's a lock, unless you are sure you're going to steal third base. And by the way, I hate when people say that, and I'm saying it right now. I assume that every time you're running and you're being aggressive and you're trying to steal a base, you're sure you're going to steal it. But with a runner on second and one out and Juan Soto at the plate, it cannot happen. And I'm going to give you a spoiler alert. Let's just jump ahead. When we go through the candidates for the Rico I'm the Man Now Star of the Series, one of the great candidates is Francisco Lindor. 4 for 9, on base 9 times in 14 plate appearances. Like, it was absurd, especially in the first two games of this series. In game one, the Edwin Diaz game, as we call it, he was on base 5 times. Wonderful series. I cannot in my stomach elect Lindor the man now because of that caught stealing in the fifth inning. It was so bad, so egregious in my mind that it almost negates the fact he was on base 150 times in this series. That may sound irrational. That may sound crazy. I'm just being honest. Like, when we get to that later, just keep that in the back of your mind. I'm going to have a tough time saying Lindor is the man now. And I think that that caught stealing in the fifth inning, and the reason I'm spending so much time on it, it is a problem now with this team. And the only reason it didn't continue in Sunday's game is because they never got on base against Hunter Green. But in Saturday's case, in a game in which they scored 3 runs, they had 9 base hits, they drew 5 walks, so they had a lot of base runners, a lot of traffic in that game on Saturday. They ran themselves out of a couple of outs, and it can't happen. Just can't happen. But that's why they lost Saturday and Sunday. They didn't hit. They didn't hit. And when they finally had opportunities in this game, and there's so many of them, one out double in the sixth inning by Alonzo, McNeil grounds out. Vientos has this really good at-bat, draws a walk. Beatty strikes out. Soto walks, steals a base. Nimmo strikes out. They have 2 on, 2 out. Big spot in the eighth inning of this game. And Francisco Alvarez came up because he had entered the game after Jared Young had successfully pinch hit, hit a home run. He strikes out looking. And then they have a chance in the ninth inning. And Nimmo and Alonso put together back-to-back strikeouts as they can't rally against Emilio Pagan. So they didn't do Jonah Tong many favors. As far as what I thought about Tong on Saturday, it was, again, a very mixed result. It's odd. Tong's made 2 starts for this team. And I don't have, like, a strong view of him yet. I feel like even through 2 starts, I'm intrigued. I still need to see more. And keep this in mind when we talk about these young starters. Obviously, Jonah Tong has a lot of potential and can be a great starter in the future. I'm talking about the short term of right now. I think Tong is going to be in the Met rotation next year, and he should be in the Met rotation next year. But we're talking about today. We're talking about the 3 or 4 starts he may have the rest of the year, the confidence that we are may not have in him making a postseason start, because that's what we're seeing, assuming the Mets can hold on and make the postseason. So there is a lot of evaluation going on by all of us. He had another quick first inning, which he had in his first start. And then, I guess in just baseball being the weirdest sport in the world, he had problems with the home run ball. And when you look at his success at AA and his brief success at AAA, he was not giving up home runs. That was not an issue for him. And he gives up 3 home runs in this game. Sal Stewart hit a bomb. Matt McClain hit one. Austin Hayes hit a screaming bomb of a home run. I think that one was a line drive. So the gopher ball hurt him. He had some control issues. But he also showed you, I think varying degrees, the moxie that he has, the incredible stuff that he has. I mean, he was popping that fastball at 96, 97. So you can see the stuff that Tong has. You see the potential, how good he can be. You could also see how deceptive he is and why, as a batter, it would be tough to hit. And I thought his overall stat was okay. I mean, that's how I would define it. I think what impressed me the most is that after he gives up the home run to Austin Hayes, and the Mets are down 4-1 in the fourth inning, I think we obviously all look at this and say, well, that's not a good start. He's given up four runs. It's the fourth inning. But what's so important is length. This team doesn't get a lot of length. And when you look at the day before when the Mets had to go through all of their top guys in their bullpen, they weren't exactly in a position of strength when it came to going to their bullpen. So for Jonah Tong, after the home run he gave up to Austin Hayes, to deliver three more scoreless innings, not allow a base hit, not allow a run, and get through six, I thought took what was probably a C-minus start and sort of made it a B-minus start. And I haven't said this in a while about this team, but I'll say it from Saturday. If they were hitting a little bit, that start would have been good enough. It would have been. But because they only gave Jonah Tong one run, at least while he was still on the mound, they didn't tack on their second run until the home run by Jared Young in the seventh inning, then it wasn't. And so you look at six innings, four runs, and you say, eh, not good enough. I thought it was a decent start by him. I thought he continued to show the potential that he has, and I'm intrigued to see him start again, and he will, Friday night against Jacob DeGrom. What a spot that'll be. But it was a weird start, too, because think about this. He gives up three home runs, and he walks four guys, and those were his base runners. He didn't give up a single in this game. He didn't give up a base hit besides the three home runs he gave up, and then obviously you mix in the four walks. And Mendy pushed him a little bit, I thought, which I appreciated. He ended up throwing 96 pitches in this game, but after he got through the fifth and he struck out Novelli Marte, his pitch count's 82. And the Reds had the heart of the batting order coming up, including Austin Hayes, who had hit the home run a few innings earlier. So I wasn't sure that Mendy was going to stick with him. But he did, and he was rewarded. And you'd later find out, which we already knew, why you stick with him. Because there ain't much in this bullpen you can trust. On Friday's Rico Bronya, episode 543, I said, look, Ryan Stanek may not be in the circle of trust, but if you're ranking guys that on a trust level, how many guys are really behind him? I mean, a lot of guys are behind him. I mean, how many guys are really in front of him? Tyler Rogers, Brooks Raley, Edwin Diaz, that's it. Now, card subject to change, Reed Garrett was activated on Sunday. I think we'd put Reed Garrett above him, and that is true. But on Saturday or on Friday, there ain't many guys above him. So when Mendy goes to Stanek in the seventh inning of a game that is now 4-2 because of the Jared Young home run, I'm not confident, but I also really have no issue with this move because I would ask anyone who does, where did you want to go? They're not going to use Brooks Raley on a back-to-back, or at least in this situation, I don't think they were going to use him on a back-to-back. Gregory Soto has been not good in his last handful of appearances. Plus, I think you had, who'd you have coming up? A switch, a righty, and a lefty. I guess you could have. You could have gone to Soto, but I don't trust him right now. Hagenman, Suero, barely knew you. Ryan Helsley, like there ain't a lot. But what we saw when Stanek came in was the worst of Ryan Stanek. So I didn't have an issue going to him, but I'll tell you where I did have an issue. Because it ain't always easy here with Carlos Mendoza. I may tell you I didn't mind that move, but at times you got to pivot. And here's where he needed to pivot. He comes in. He's ahead of Spencer Steer, 0-2. Steer rips a base hit. Okay. One on, nobody out. Then Sal Stewart comes up and hits a ball that I thought was out, that I think all of us thought was out. Goes to very deep left field. Brandon Nimmo goes to the warning track, the wall, and catches it with his derriere right up against the left field fence. At that point, I'm worried. I mean, I think we're all worried, but I'm getting the bullpen warmed up. I'm getting somebody warmed up. At this, now I don't even care if it's guys I trust. I know that Ryan Stanek doesn't have it. It's obvious. The first two batters smoked the ball off of him. Then Jose Trevino comes up, and he dunks in a base hit. So now Stanek has fulfilled his obligation of facing three batters. Two of them got on. The one that didn't hit the ball to the wall. Carlos, if you're listening right now, you know, you're en route to Philadelphia, And you're like, let me check out what that dweeb's talking about. Let me see what's happening. Carlos, I ask you, if I knew and everyone in the audience knew that Fat Thor didn't have it with three guys, three batters, which is your minimum, telling it to you loud and clearly with two base hits and a ball near the fence, why have him face Matt McClain? Well, Mendy does. And what does Ryan Stanek do? He gets ahead of him and then loses him. He walks him. So now the bases are loaded with one out. Again, it's a 4-2 game. This game is not over. And he leaves him in again. He lets him.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Him face TJ Friedl. Why? He's now faced four batters. Three of them are on base, and the other one hit the ball to the wall. I hated that. He finally, after TJ Friedl rips a base hit to make it a three-run game, takes him out, goes to Kevin Harrigan. And again, it didn't matter who you were going to, because I acknowledge that anyone you're going to is not someone you trust. You're not going now to Raleigh or Rogers or obviously Diaz in this spot down by two runs or three runs. I get that. Not arguing that. I'm merely saying once one guy is identified as not having it, get someone else in. And think about what Kevin Harrigan did. He strikes out Nouveli Marte, stunningly enough, and he's a batter away from getting through it. And then he walks Ellie De La Cruz. He had no margin for error either. And then gets Austin Hayes out. Got lucky. It was a line drive. It was right at Lindor. So the damage, I don't want to say, is limited.
On Tuesday, August 26th, it's FanDuel Futures Day, a new holiday for football fans. It's 24 hours of deals on all your football season predictions. So take a flyer on the MVP race. Who's your pick for the crown? You think it'll be Josh Allen, Patrick Mahomes? Who do you think's going to win the Super Bowl? You going Eagles? You going Chiefs? You going someone else? You could also parlay your division winner dark horses. Mark your calendars. This is your day for your hunches, your hot takes, your calls, and your odds. Visit the FanDuel app today and start playing your futures bets now, because Future Day is one day and one day only. FanDuel, play your game.
Must be 21 plus and present in Virginia. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
I'm Kristen Press.
And I'm Tobin Heath.
We're World Cup winners, Olympians, and the hosts of The Recap Show.
Every week, we sit down with the icons, disruptors, and game changers on the field and beyond it to talk victories, heartbreaks, and everything in between.
We've built a space where athletes, changemakers, and people creating the future of women's sports can show up and show off as their full, unapologetic selves.
Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, guys? I'm Jordan Robinson, host of the podcast, The Women's Hoop Show. We're heading towards the home stretch of the WNBA season, and there is so much to get into every episode. Twice a week, I'm joined by one of my amazing co-hosts as we dissect the biggest games, performances, and even some off-court drama. The playoffs are quickly approaching, and now is the best time to tune in. Who will come away as this year's champion? The competition is heating up, and so are we. Listen to and follow The Women's Hoop Show, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Because now it's a 6-2 game, so I think it's pretty damaging. But Harrigan didn't implode the game. You just went to him too late. Yeah, it would have been nice if the Met offense could wake up. It's 6-2. There's no law against them not rallying. But what's been weird about this team, and I admit a little concerning about this team, is that they have not won a game trailing after 8. And Gary Cohen has mentioned this a lot. We've mentioned this a lot on the Rico. I've cited it as one of the many examples where this team has shown like they have a glass jaw. Now, they've made some decent comebacks. You can have comebacks without it having to be in the ninth inning, but it is odd that we're sitting here in the middle of September And the Mets are now the only team in baseball to have not come back in the ninth inning. And what's funny is, as the Mets failed to come back in the ninth, they did a little Fugazi rally, Lindor double, Soto single, and that was before Nimmo and Alonso struck out back-to-back to end the game. They still needed one more base runner to get the tying run to the plate. So they didn't exactly complete the full Met Fugazi tease by getting the tying run to the plate, but they came close. So as they lose this game, and I consumed this game hours after it ended. I went to Hershey Park on Saturday. I had a very good time. So I watched this game late Saturday night. I'm now interested in what else happened in baseball. I'm battling Pete Hoffman in fantasy, but I can't really keep up on much. Like, I'll tell you a weird thing that I do. I'm driving back from Hershey Park. Obviously, the Mets are on DVR, but I want to know how Jacob DeGrom is doing. He's on my fantasy team. I want to know how Brandon Woodruff's doing. He's on my fantasy team. So as I'm driving home, I say to my wife, do me a favor. And I'm so crazy, I won't even let her go to the MLB app because I don't want her to see a Mets score. I don't want her to know anything. So I say, Google Brewers. And she said, okay. She Googles Brewers. She says, okay, it's 3-0 Brewers. I'm like, okay, thank you. Needed to know that. Have Brandon Woodruff on my fantasy team. I say, Google Rangers Astros. She does it. Up 3-0 Astros. I said, okay, thank you. So I knew those scores, but I didn't know anything else. And the reason I tell you this is, so I'm done with the Met game. It's midnight. Let me see what's going on in baseball. Let me see what happened in baseball. And I hear about Yoshinobu Yamamoto taking a no-hitter in the ninth inning and the Dodgers losing. And I'm like, wow, that's crazy. So he took a no-hitter in the ninth inning and they lost. So I go on YouTube and watch the entire ninth inning. Holy shit. I mean, so Yamamoto, for those that didn't see this, Yamamoto is an out away from a no-hitter in the ninth inning. His pitch count's like 110. But Cousin Dave is thinking, you know what? 3-0 lead. He's an out away from a no-hitter. I got you. I'm gonna keep him in. Okay? Not going to take him out. And so I think it was Jackson Holliday hits a two-out home run, breaks up the no-hitter, breaks up the shutout. Davey Martin comes out immediately, takes Yamamoto out of the game. 3-1, two outs, nobody on. And Blake Treinen comes in, gives up like back-to-back hits and a walk. Then Tanner Scott comes in, gives up a hit, and they lose. And the reason I bring this story up is not just to talk about Dodgers Orioles. The Orioles, that team, the team that came back, were the only team along with the Mets who had not rallied and won a game in the ninth inning when trailing after eight or trailing into the ninth inning. They were the only team with the Mets, and look how they rallied. Two outs, nobody on, about to be no hit, down 3-0. That is one of the... It's actually one of the great rallies you'll ever see. One of the most, like, wildest out of nowhere rallies that you'll ever see. So I would like for the Mets at some point, can they give us a rally in which they're trailing going into the ninth? Better yet, how about you never trail in the ninth, just win every day the rest of the season? I guess that would be better. But I'd like to see it happen. And it did not happen on Saturday. And it certainly wasn't going to happen on Sunday. Now, Sunday was an interesting day. I consumed the game while watching the Jets. That was quite a challenge. And here's what I got out of Sunday. Brandon Sproat pitched well. Brandon Sproat, in a lot of ways, was really, really, really impressive. He walks the first batter of his major league career on 4 pitches and then gets ahead of the next hitter, gets Marte to hit the ball on the ground, and Brett Beatty performs magic by making and turning a really impressive 5-4-3 double play. So what could have been disastrous in the first inning when you walk the leadoff hitter on 4 pitches turns into a nice, relatively easy inning helped out by wonderful defense by Brett Beatty. Pitches a 1-2-3 second, does the same thing in the third in which he walks Tyler Stevenson on 4 pitches, but quietly gets the next 3 guys out all on strikeout. So K's the side after he does it in the third. Almost does the same thing in the fourth. He walks the leadoff hitter, this time on five pitches. Except when you put the leadoff man on, even though the Reds couldn't do it in the first inning or the third inning, and the Mets don't normally do this, you can actually manufacture a run. Marte stole a base, advanced to third on a ground out, scored on a sacrifice fly in which Cedric Mullins didn't even like attempt to get him out. Or did he attempt to get, maybe I'm thinking of a different play where he threw right to the cutoff man. All I know is I'm done with Cedric Mullins. Like I never loved him. I never wanted him that much. I kind of viewed the trade as whatever. Sure, they had a warm body that can play center field, but I was never enamored by him because I don't think he's that good. Well, this guy's come here and he's been worse than the guy that wasn't that good in Baltimore. That's a problem. It's not like he's coming here and he's producing the way he did in Baltimore, which wasn't that good. He's come here and he's been worse. That's the reality. He's not that good defensively. He hasn't hit a lick. What does he do? What does he do? You cannot tell me that he's a better option than Jeff McNeil. It's not true. And I'll take it up another level on this. I know Ronnie Mauricio is basically, he doesn't exist anymore. We don't even see Ronnie Mauricio. He's not even in the mix anymore. Fine. Vientos, Beatty, and McNeil could simply play every freaking day. Or you could really stack your defense by playing Acuna at second base because God knows the guy can play over there at a high level. So you have options to make sure that we don't have to watch Cedric Mullins. But let me get back to Sproat. So unfortunately, the leadoff walk does him in because the Reds get a run out of it, tying the game up at one, erasing the Beatty home run that he had hit a few innings earlier. After that, pitches a good fifth inning, works around a two-out walk. Then you have kind of the moment of truth in the sixth inning. And even though the sixth inning would basically be the difference in this game, I thought there were things about what Sproat did that were impressive. So it's a 1-1 game in the sixth inning. The Mets are not hitting Hunter Green. We'll get back to that in a little bit. Gives up a one-out, just bleep. Not bleep. Bloop was the word I was looking for to Marte. Yes, it was the first hit of the game. Yes, it broke up the no-hitter. And yes, I was thinking about it. But because it was 1-1 and you knew they're not going to let Sproat go more than 95 pitches, it wasn't like a big deal. It was a no-hitter. I understood it. I paid attention to it. It wasn't one of those, ooh, no-hitter. Let me text the world. So he gives up this bloop hit to Marte. And really, the next two batters and the next two sequences is probably what's going to keep Brandon Sproat up at night. He gets ahead of Ellie De La Cruz, 1-2, and throws, I think it was a slider that just hung. And Cruz hit the crap out of it up the alley in right center field to give the Reds the lead. Then he gets ahead of Austin Hayes, and Hayes hits a ground ball that Brett Beatty's got to make the play on. Cruz is on third because that double got him to third base on the throw. So the Mets had the infield in, and Beatty's got to make that play. Now, Beatty made a great play in the first inning, which was a pivotal play, turning that double play that made sure that first inning didn't get worse. But specifically in the sixth inning, he's got to pick that. He's got to hold the runner. And quite frankly, it should be 2-1. And who knows? But even after that base hit, because it was ruled a base hit, and it was hit hard, what would I score it? Honestly, I'm a dick. I'd score it an error. Because it went right under his glove. I mean, it's an error. He's a major leaguer. It's not me playing in the backyard. But what impressed me was right after that, Mendy kept him in the game, and Sproat struck out Lux and Stewart back-to-back. And so Sproat was at least able to finish his start on a positive note, and I thought he pitched really, really well. I thought he was better than six innings, three runs. I think six innings, three runs, four walks. Like, we have the pitching lineup on our screen if you're consuming this on YouTube. If not, I'll read it to you. Six innings, three hits, three runs, four walks, seven strikeouts, 88 pitches. And you hear it and you're like, it's okay. I think he was better than okay. And we play a game around here on the Rico where at the end of every series now, assuming the Mets make the playoffs and they still have work to do, what would our rotation be? And Nolan McLean is pretty easy, I think. Hoff and I always agree McLean's in the rotation. I'm still okay with David Peterson despite his mediocrity. But that third spot's a big question. Hoff's been saying, use an opener. Pitch everybody an inning. After what Sproat did in literally one start, I'm all ready to say I would have Sproat and Tong share a game. That would be my new updated if the playoffs started today rotation. It would be Nolan McLean, David Peterson, and I have the kids, Sproat and Tong, tag team a game three. That's where I'm at. And card subject to change, right? Let's see what Clay Holmes does in his next start. Let's see what Sean Manaea does in his next start. But I'm going to write that down because that is my, that's my latest if the season ended today. And I have it written down. After the Detroit series, I was McLean, Peterson, Holmes. After the Miami series, I was McLean, Peterson, Manaea. Now, Pete Hoffman had a very busy day today because he actually produces the New York Giants. Boy, the vibes on the Giants changed quickly, right? Everybody was all giddy about the season. Okay. Still suck. We'll get more into that on The Fan on Monday. If the season ended today now, Hoff, give me your rotation.
Nolan McLean, Brandon Sproat. You may hate this, but I like Jonah Tong.
So you go all kids. All kids.
I'm going all kids. And you have the veterans to come in and spell them if needed. Because that's what, listen, they're not doing their job for the to start the game, but I trust them at some point in time to give me a few innings to go deep if these kids have a rough patch. So I'd rather have that, the three kids start and the veterans come in, rather than vice versa.
Here's what's so crazy about the kids and the veterans. We talk about length and six innings, not that that's amazing, but yes, in 2025, it almost feels amazing. Let's go through the last batch of Mets starts. Obviously, Brandon Sproat went six, Jonah Tong went six. David Peterson, 5 1/3. Clay Holmes, 4 2/3. Nolan McLean, 6. Great. Sean Manaea, 3 2/3. Kodai Senga, 4 2/3. David Peterson, 2. The last time the Mets got six innings from a non-kid starting pitcher, you have to go all the way back to August 23rd when Clay Holmes pitched into the seventh inning. That's the last time Sproat, Tong, or McLean weren't the reasons why they had a starting pitcher go six innings. Meanwhile, Sproat just went six, Tong just went six, and McLean has gone at least six in every start he's made since his major league debut. So even with the lack of experience that they have, what you have to love about them in such a short sample size is they do things the veterans can't do, which is go six freaking innings.
Yeah, and again, we've seen McLean battle through some issues and get through it and still go strong, give you five good innings after that rough inning. Jonah Tong has had some moments. I really would like to see him, you know, fine-tune a few more things to give me some more confidence, but he does look like he can get it and will get it. And then Brandon Sproat, again, I didn't get to watch the game. But, I mean, look at this. This is a quality start right here. I don't know if many people know what
it
is.
It was a very good start, bro. I thought it was better than the line. I'm telling you. I thought he was really, really impressive. He showed a lot of poise. He was attacking. I thought Sproat was fantastic. Now, speaking of the kids.
Oh, could I just say something about Jonah Tong, too? Because I do want to say something. I know that the Mets may not be able to hit in a bandbox, but that's what Great American Ballpark is. Like, Jonah Tong gave up, what, three home runs?
Three home runs, yes.
Yeah, that's what they do. If we saw series before that Toronto and the Reds were putting up 12-9 scores, they put up double-digit scores left and right. Like, that is a ballpark that offenses go in and just load up on. Mets couldn't do that.
Yeah, unfortunately. They did it a little bit in game one. They didn't do it in game two or game three. Speaking of Nolan McLean, he's going to be on the mound for the opener of the series against the Philadelphia Phillies. And he is the guy I want to talk about in the pick segment brought to you by FanDuel Sportsbook. Make every moment more. I've made this pick, I think about a week ago or 2 weeks ago, but I'm going to do it again because right now on the FanDuel Sportsbook app, Nolan McLean's over under for strikeouts in Monday's start is 5.5. and I will gladly take the over with McLean. Once again, that was the pick segment brought to you by FanDuel Sportsbook. Make every moment more. Let's get back to the Met offense. I'm going to take a lot of crap for saying what I'm about to say, but I always want to be honest. Saturday pissed me off. Saturday was a game of missed opportunities. Brady Singer was not that good. In the ninth inning, Emilio Pagan was not that good. The Mets left opportunities out there. In Sunday's game, they got dominated by a stud. Hunter Greene was throwing 101 miles an hour. His stuff was nasty. His command was on point. It was one of those games, and I do not say this often, where I literally have to tip my hat. This was most of the time when the Mets don't score runs, we talk about the LD offense. All right. For those that are new, it's just an inappropriate way to describe how bad the Met offense is. Pretty limp, to say the least. But watching Hunter Greene from jump, when he struck out the side in the first inning, when he then struck out the first two guys in the second, and it looked like he was going to put together an immaculate inning before Jeff McNeil grounded out. I mean,
it's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Outside of the Brett Beatty mistake, where Beatty crushed the first pitch he saw with one out in the third inning over the right field fence, Hunter Greene was so locked in. He was so on point. There weren't missed opportunities. There weren't really many hard hit balls. Pete Alonso had a good cut in the fourth inning with one out when he hit one to dead center that I thought had a chance to get out. But what we witnessed over seven innings on Sunday, if you watch this, was I just think an ace dominating. I give credit to Hunter Greene. I think what was more frustrating was the eighth and ninth inning. That once you got Greene out after seven brilliant innings, the Mets are down 3-1. They can come back. And the bottom of the order against Nick Martinez did absolutely nothing. Alvarez flied out. His bat has been relatively quiet since coming back off the IL. Beatty grounded out. Mark Vientos came up as a pinch hitter for Cedric Mullins, who shouldn't have been playing to begin with, and he grounded out. And then the ninth inning was really frustrating because the Reds, who are a flawed baseball team, clearly gave the Mets an opportunity. After Soto hits the solo bomb, Juan Soto was back, to at least get this to a one-run game. Pete Alonso hits a ground ball to shortstop, and Ellie De La Cruz throws the ball away. And so the Mets are set up with a runner on and one out, and here's where I'm baffled. I admit I'm baffled. So Alonso is on first base. Clearly Carlos Mendoza, desperation time, down by a run. I got this secret weapon on the bench in Luis Angel Acuna. I'm going to go to Acuna. How can you not? While I'm not a fan necessarily of pinch running for Pete Alonso, there are moments where you have to. And down a run, ninth inning, one out, Acuna on the bench, absolute no-brainer. This Met team runs at will. Too much, as I was talking about at the beginning of this podcast. Way too much. Super aggressive. They got to pipe down on it, right? And here's Acuna out there with four pitches to work with. Can you steal second base, bro? This is why you're here. This is why you're in the game. Steal second base. And he doesn't do it. So when Nimmo came through with the base at the left field, I got to admit, part of me was kind of annoyed because I'm thinking to myself, that should have tied the game, or it should have set up first and third where then Nimmo could have been on cue to steal second or maybe just try to steal that run to tie the game up. So for a team that runs all the time, it was frustrating to see Acuna not be able to steal second base in that spot. That's why you're in the game. And then obviously Starling Marte comes up and just, look, Marte's cooled off. And I think this is where the lineup debate will get a little bit more interesting, because for a while, Marte was hot, and the Mets' best lineup was with Marte at DH, Vientos at third, Beatty at second, McNeil in center, especially to not have Cedric Mullins out there. But Marte's cooled off. I think he's 2 for his last 23, 1 for his last 14, and he comes up in this huge spot with 2 on, 1 out. Mets have a chance to come back. They've got a chance to do the thing they haven't done all year, and he bounces into a 6-4-3 double play. I think right now, and they're going to face a lot of lefties, so I think that will change things a little bit. Marte should play with those lefties on the mound. They're going to face 3 straight lefties in the Philadelphia series. But I am intrigued by the idea of giving a few more ABs to Luis Angel Acuña. Not because I think he's going to hit, but because you so solidify yourself defensively by having Acuña at second base. McNeil's good at second. Acuña's better. You could have Acuña at second, Beatty at third, McNeil in center, Vientos at DH. In Sunday's case, they wanted to give Juan Soto a DH day. I'm not going to complain about that. I'm never going to complain about giving one of your big bats a DH day. You know, use the DH to your advantage. And it sort of has been surprising at times that the Mets haven't. Like, we haven't seen Pete Alonso have a lot of DH days. We haven't seen Francisco Lindor have a lot of DH days. But I'm certainly not against it. But the offense did nothing. I think in Sunday's case, a lot of it had to do with the dominance of Hunter Green. Let me read some of your emails, therico@gmail.com. Zachary has a question. Hopefully I have an answer. Evan, have the Mets ever won a game with Brandon Nimmo batting fourth? Why does Mendoza continue to bat him third or fourth so consistently? They barely score any runs when they bat him that high in the lineup. Nimmo has good counting stats, but he's not clutch and strikes out too much. He should be batting sixth. The lineup should be going forward: Lindor, Soto, McNeil, Alonso, Vientos, Nimmo, Beatty, Alvarez, Mullins, or Taylor. This is so obvious, and yet Mendoza continues to run these lineups that make you scratch your head. It's a great question. The Mets never win games when Brandon Nimmo's batting cleanup. Believe it or not, I did research. I wanted to know. Obviously, I know they've won games with him hitting cleanup, but I was curious, what is the Mets' record with Brandon Nimmo batting cleanup? So I have an answer. He has batted cleanup in 38 games this season. And the answer is 23-15. So pretty much right where they are. Actually, a little bit better than where they are. So it has not been as big of a hindrance as Zach thinks. Fred writes, there's no way anyone can justify playing Cedric Mullins in this series, let alone 2 straight games. He offers nothing except being the automatic net negative of any series. On that note, Leo writes, am I the only one who noticed how much I miss Tyrone Taylor? If Tyrone Taylor was in center field for Game 2 against Cincinnati, he would probably have caught the first home run off of Tong and might have caught the second one as well. Defense matters. I'm very much looking forward to his return from the IL. I don't know if he would have robbed both of those, but he would have had a shot. And there's no doubt that they miss him defensively. Like, he's had little spurts where he's hit, but overall, he's had a pretty awful offensive season. Watching Cedric Mullins every day has made me appreciate how much better Tyrone Taylor is defensively. Dan writes, it's been an unbelievable weapon stealing bases, but once teams start to catch on, and you start running yourself out of multiple innings, Francisco and also Juan got picked off twice in Detroit, that's the sign that you have to start deploying it more strategically. It's like in football when you save a play for an important time so you get the defense when they're not looking for it. The word is spreading, and it's time to be more selective when they break it out. So when you really need one in a crucial spot, you have people off guard instead of anticipating it. A little P.S., a little different when a game isn't over by the third, isn't it? What does he mean by that? I'm trying to think. Oh, because the game isn't over by the third inning. I don't know what he means by that. Anyhow, let me get back to what I did understand. 1000% right. And we talked about this at the beginning of the Rico. Like, they are unhinged when it comes to leaving early and trying to steal bases. And I know that Juan Soto wants to get the 40-40. He's got to be smarter about it. They all do, specifically Lindor, because what Lindor did in Saturday's game, when he got caught trying to steal third with Juan Soto at the plate, that's a big problem, and it cannot happen again. You can knock one out of the park and raise the apple with Takara Chuhai, a sparkling cocktail that blends real shochu spirits with delicious flavors of fruits locally grown in Japan. It's available at Citi Field and Fuji Apple, of course, white peach and lemon. I can't wait to have one on Friday at Citi because it is all lined up. Jacob DeGrom's return night is happening Friday night against Jonah Tong, assuming the Mets don't mess with the rotation. And I assume, looking at the rotation and the way it's set up for the next week or so, that everything will stay intact through this homestand. This homestand begins on Friday, but you look at, hold on, there's a bug right in front of me, and I'm really going to try to kill this thing. Hopefully PETA doesn't get offended by that.
I won't get offended, no. I'll be fine. Oh, PETA. I thought you meant Peter.
Oh, I killed him with my bare hand. Oh, my God.
Look at that. Swift over there.
I don't know if the video caught that, but yeah, I swatted him and I killed him.
Well, we'll try to get a replay.
Because it's a living being. But it kept flying around. It was annoying me.
First of all, it's in your house. It's your house, not his house. Second of all, they do lay eggs, right? Don't they?
You're right. That's probably why this bug is flying around. There's probably a mother bug that laid an egg.
Right. You can't have that. So you got to kill him. Sorry. The trespassing. You're allowed to do that.
I'm not even kidding you. A part of this bug's wing is stuck on my tablet right now as I'm looking at the pitching alignments. But yeah, so here's the way things are set up. And we can try to find the spot for Kodai Senga, assuming he comes back. Tyler McGill is also going to be activated in the next couple of days. His last few rehab performances were not good, but they could use him in the bullpen. I mean, honestly, this is not a good bullpen. They don't have a lot of great options. And I've said for years here on the Rico, I've been intrigued by McGill out of the bullpen. And I think things are setting up right now for him to be in the pen. So McClain Monday against Aaron Nola, Manaea Tuesday against Ranger Suarez, Clay Holmes Wednesday, Manaea Tuesday against Ranger Suarez, Clay Holmes Wednesday against Christopher Sanchez, David Peterson versus Jesus Luzardo on Thursday. So that kind of completes this rotation from this weekend. Tong on Friday against DeGrom, Sproat on Saturday, because he absolutely deserves another start, and then Nolan McClain would come back on Sunday with technically an extra day of rest because they're using a six-man rotation. Then they have an off day on Monday. And so these off days may make things tricky because if you keep a six-man rotation with the multiple off days, you're talking about a week between starts. So if you're going to reinsert Kodai, if you're going to pull Manaea, I mean, I don't think Sean Manaea is guaranteed another start after Tuesday. I think Manaea's pitching for his, not his career, obviously, but he's pitching for his rotation spot. But then they have San Diego and Washington, off day, Chicago, Miami. It is lined up, if the Mets choose, to have Nolan McClain Monday against the Phillies, Sunday against Texas, the following Sunday against the Nationals, and then he would be lined up for the final Sunday of the year against Miami. Obviously, if the Mets have a playoff spot wrapped up, they could hold him off from that, maybe use him a few days earlier in a tune-up, and he would be then set to pitch game one of a wild card series. But one thing the Mets have to figure out, and this is going to be very, very important, is they got to make the goddamn playoffs. We sit here all day talking about them making it. This is the rotation. They've got to pull it off. And what's happened over the last week, without us fully noticing, is that instead of it just being they got to hold off Cincinnati, they got to hold off San Francisco, they got to hold off Arizona, they got to hold off St. Louis. Going into Monday's action, the Mets are sitting at 67 losses. Okay, and that's all we're going to focus on, losses, the loss column. They're at 67, the Reds are at 71, and San Francisco is at 71. The Reds have the tiebreaker now. That is done and official and easy to understand. If the Reds make up four games on the Mets, Cincinnati makes it over us. If the Giants make up four games on the Mets would still make it because they have the tiebreaker on San Francisco. And thankfully, the Giants lost their last two games to the Cardinals. The problem is, here come the Cardinals, because the Cardinals are at 72 losses. Again, the Mets are at 67. So there's a five-game difference. Luckily, the Mets have the tiebreaker. So St. Louis is one of those teams where it'll be tough for them because they've got to not just make up five games, they got to make up six games because they have to pass the Mets. Then you have Arizona. Maybe you weren't paying attention late Sunday afternoon. A lot of football going on. But the Red Sox and the Diamondbacks played a game in which Arizona was looking for the sweep. And thankfully, the Red Sox won. And I say thankfully because the Diamondbacks are at 72 losses, only five behind the Mets. Now, the Diamondbacks are very complicated when it comes to tiebreakers. Mets and Arizona split the season series. So there is no tiebreak winner from the head-to-head. The next tiebreaker is your record inside your division. The Mets currently, and obviously these numbers are going to change because they're about to play four games against Philadelphia, and they still have those three games against the Nationals at the end of their home regular season and games in Miami at the end of the regular season. But their record inside their division currently is 23-19. The Diamondbacks inside their division, also subject to change, is 22-18. So there's no answer to the tiebreaker. I'm going to venture a guess. Because the Diamondbacks have to make up five games on the Mets, and they are playing plenty of games inside their division, if they make up those five games and the Mets lose those five games, there's a really good chance Arizona will finish with a better record against the division, which means they will own the tiebreaker, which means right now, Cincinnati and Arizona are the teams with the likely tiebreakers, the Giants and the Cardinals not. And so when teams play each other that are chasing the New York Mets, that's kind of one way to figure out who to root for. Let me give you an example. So this week, while the Mets are playing the Philadelphia Phillies, the Reds are playing the Padres. Well, let's start right there. Catching the Padres, Mets are now two games behind. It don't mean that much. We talked about it briefly on the last Rico. Like, does it really matter if the Mets are wild card two or wild card number three? The priority is making the postseason. So Reds, Padres, pretty straightforward. You root for San Diego. St. Louis is playing the Mariners. Obviously, you root for the Mariners. But the Diamondbacks are playing the Giants. This one's a little tricky because the Giants are closer in the standings, but the Diamondbacks are likely to have the tiebreaker. So I would tell you that in game one, at least, I would root for the Diamondbacks. But as that series goes on, that may vary. And you know what that also tells you? Besides, I have too much time on my hands. It tells you that the Mets have to win their own games. Because if they can just win their own games, they'll make the playoffs. And we're not going to have to sweat out the next couple of weeks and break down who we should root for between the Diamondbacks and the Giants. But that's the circumstance as far as the playoffs are concerned. Now, just to put a bow on these three games against Cincinnati, where the Mets did lose two out of three and lose the tiebreaker, let us name Rico, I'm the Man Now, star of the series, and our net negative. Let's start with the net negative. I think it's Pete Alonso. I think that when you look at why the Mets lost this series, why they lost two out of three to Cincinnati, the easy answer, as I said at the very top of this podcast, is they did not hit. They didn't hit. So you can go through Ryan Stanek's performance, or you can go through any pitching letdown that you find. I think overall, Pete Alonso going 1 for 12, but going 0 for 5 with runners in scoring position probably damaged them the most offensively. So I think it's Pete. You know, I love Pete. I don't feel like I have to say that every time I say something negative about him, but I do think overall he was the net negative of this series. I'll give you some other candidates. Starling Marte did not play in game two of this series, and he did have an RBI single in game one, but I kind of think of Starling Marte, especially because of the way game three ended, by him coming up in this huge spot with two guys on base and bouncing into a double play. I think he's an honorable mention. Look at Hoffman. He puts up Brandon Nimmo's 2 for 10 and says, "What about him? What about Brandon Nimmo?"
I didn't say it like that. I was like more like, "Hey, look at Brandon Nimmo. He kind of sucked too." How about this? Ryan Stanek. There you go. That's a good.
So the problem with Ryan Stanek being the guy is that he got big outs in game one. You know, he came into a very tricky spot and got 2 huge strikeouts to bail David Peterson out of the 6th inning. So as bad as he was in game 2 of this series, I think he deserves a lot of credit for what he did in game 1. I got to tell you, I think this is fairly straightforward. I think Pete Alonso, for the 5th time this year, which I think is amongst the leaders, is going to be your net negative for this losing 2 out of 3 series to Cincinnati.
All right, so how many series have we had?
That's a great question, Pete. The New York Mets have now had 44 series.
He's had 5 net negatives. How many I'm the man now has he won?
6.
So he's had 11 out of 40 something. He's 25% of the effectiveness of this team.
I think that when you're a star player, there's a heavy burden. He's a star player. He's batting 3rd or 4th in the lineup. I mean, yeah, and the big situations are going to find you. And you rely on that player to come through in the big situations. Here's the reality. I'll make this very simple. The Mets didn't hit on Saturday and Sunday. It's the main reason they lost this series. And Pete Alonso didn't do anything to help. So that's it. He's the net negative. As far as the Rico, I'm the man now star of the series, honorable mention of Brandon Sproat, who I thought pitched very well in his major league debut. Honorable mention to Edwin Diaz. I know some people want to give it to Edwin Diaz. Here's the reason I can't give it to Edwin Diaz. He created the mess. Like, I thank Edwin Diaz for escaping. I thought he showed great poise, great grit, the changing of the cleats, the sprinting to first base to cover, the strikeouts. Like, it was an unbelievable moment on Friday. But he's the one who loaded the bases. So he's not the star of the series, but I do want to at least throw some flowers his way, you know?
Well, the only reason why you can say that he may have been the star of the series is because if he blew the game, then they would have lost 3 games to the Reds. And what would how many games would they be up right now by the Reds? They're 4 games up now. What would have been? 2.
It would have been disastrous, but again, he created the bases loaded, nobody out jam.
Right,
so we're celebrating him for not blowing a save, which fine. I mean, closers blow saves, but he's not the star of the series.
Hold on. But it wasn't his fault. It was the shoe's fault.
Oh, stop it. Not the shoe's fault. Give me a break. I think the other candidates, there really are 2 others. Francisco Lindor, who was on base 9 times in 14 plate appearances, and Juan Soto, who ended up going 5 for 12 in this series with a home run, the home run that he hit at the very end to make it a 1-run game. And he drove in 2 runs, and he was also on base 7 times in this series.
Yeah, but you said Lindor can't get it because he got caught stealing.
Correct. That's why, to me, the man now is Juan Soto.
Wow. Wow, you just went for it.
Well, he is. I mean, the home run in game 3, even though it's a solo home run and it fits right into the Juan Solo thing, they didn't do anything offensively. They're down by 2 runs in the 9th inning. He gave him a shot. That home run gave him a shot. And if you go back to game 1 of this series, his RBI double in the 4th inning was actually the last run the Mets scored and turned out to be the difference in the game. So I think when you look at his impact on game 1, he had 2 hits in game 1, including a stolen base that led directly to a run being scored. That stolen base, he stole 3rd base in the 1st inning. He scored on a sacrifice fly. So pretty important. So when you look at the impact he had in game 1, scoring a run, driving in a run, stealing a base, he had 2 more hits in game 2, got on base 3 times, hit the home run, obviously, to bring him back closer in game 3. I give it to Juan Soto over Francisco Lindor. I'm sorry. Those 2 caught stealings are brutal. The second one, too. Disqualified.
So I'm just going to throw it out there just for fun because I want people to know that I don't always hate on the same people over and over. Brett Beatty should get an honorable mention too, because he did hit a big home run in the in today's game. Even though they didn't win, he put up a home run.
Brett Beatty does okay. I'll give him honorable mention. At three hits in game one, hit the home run off Hunter Green. Otherwise, the Mets would have been no hit, I guess. And while he did have a bad defensive play behind Brandon Sproat with the ball that he should have played with De La Cruz on third base, he also did turn a pretty big double play in the first inning. So that's an honorable mention. But you can't tell me it's not Juan Soto. Juan Soto is the deserving I'm the man now. And you know what? That'll be the second time in 3 weeks Juan has won it. It'll be his fifth of the season, which ties him with Francisco Lindor for second on the Rico I'm the Man Now standings board. It now reads Pete Alonso 6, Soto and Lindor 5, and then there's a drop-off to David Peterson and Brandon Nimmo at 3. How about that?
How about that? That is some crazy stuff. Juan Soto catching fire at the right time, right?
He absolutely has. Look, Juan Soto has been it's not that he's had a bad year. He was not having an impactful season. He is now having major impact. No question. And hopefully that continues because the book hasn't been written yet. I think most of us, as negative as one may be, would assume the Mets are a playoff team. We assume the Mets are going to hold on and make the playoffs, but they still have work to do. I mean, they've got 19 games left. And quite frankly, I can't confidently tell you 10-9 is going to be enough because all it takes is one of those teams that's 4 or 5 games behind the Mets to go on a crazy rampage. And you never know. I mean, baseball's a weird-ass sport. You know, could the Arizona Diamondbacks just go on a crazy run? It could happen. So the Mets need to protect themselves. But I think just going 13-6 in these last 19 games, and quite frankly, they should. Look, the Phillies are a team. They play tough. I'm not asking for a sweep. Obviously, the division's over. They could sweep the Phillies all day. They ain't winning the NL East. They're 7 games out, so that's done. But can they go win 3 out of 4 against the Phillies, win 2 out of 3 against Texas, take care of business against San Diego? I know that's not the easiest thing in the world with those 10 games coming up, but it's in front of the Mets to at least just play better baseball and eliminate any scare of one of these teams coming back.
Now, with that said, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Okay. So last year it took to game 161 to clinch a playoff spot. Will this year be any different, or will it take the game 161 to 162?
It freaking better be different. This thing better be wrapped up in Chicago is the way I look at it. I mean, they can't go to Miami with this thing not wrapped up. That'd be scary and be a major disappointment. I think that right now, if you ask me, without being negative or too positive, they should make the playoffs, and it shouldn't come down to game 161. But there are some who don't think the Mets are any good, including Sean, who writes they're a bad baseball team. Again, just bringing this up, this is a bad baseball team constructed poorly with no quality pitching. We're going to miss the playoffs like a team we bought from at the deadline. We're going to miss the playoffs likely to a team we bought from at the deadline. I've been a Stearns defender, but he did not build a good rotation and has not put together a good bullpen. Pretty pathetic for months now, and the icing on the cake will be Drew Gilbert and Jose Buteau in a playoff series instead of the Mets.
How about that?
Yeah.
Lucchese, Buteau, and Gilbert, and Wilbur Flores performing for the Giants? Oh, that'll sting.
Larry Cordero writes, and this is in relation to Saturday's game, why the F is Carlos Mendoza bringing Ryan Stanek into this game? I mean, I know the options suck, but back-to-back with Fat Thor? I think it goes back to the options sucking. Now, the last email I want to read is an interesting one. It's about Edwin Diaz. On Friday's Rico Bronya, if you missed it, we talked extensively about that incredible hold on for dear life moment that Diaz had in winning on Friday. And I talked about how Edwin Diaz is becoming the best closer in the history of the franchise. In fact, that's an offseason Rico we should really focus on. Is he the best closer in the history of the franchise? And I talked a little bit about 2019, how much I didn't believe in him, how much Beningo didn't believe in him, and how it's amazing that Diaz has come such a long way. Howard writes, Evan, you get no pass on 2019 Edwin Diaz. I appreciated the Rico on Friday and how you lauded Edwin for his words post-game and his guts in general. But you and Joe and the rest of WFAN were way too harsh on Edwin in 2019. Yes, he gave up home runs. Yes, he helped the Mets cost the season. But you omitted the underlying numbers were not as bad as the results. And he showed incredible ability and stuff. He stood up and faced the music after each loss, including the Kurt Suzuki home run. It showed tremendous character. And through 15 home runs and numerous blown saves, every single time he stood there and admitted fault and answered every question, even sometimes through tears. You were way too harsh on him then, and your absolving of your reaction now is not warranted. There were many of us who stood by Edwin then, and of course, we're all Met fans. I'm always displeased with how you and others acted towards Edwin in 2019. You had a chance today to admit fault, but you did not do so. Very disappointing. And I know you do not care what I think. Well, hold on a sec. I do care what you think. I wouldn't have read your email if I didn't. So I appreciate your feedback towards my negativity on Edwin Diaz in 2019. And if you want me to admit fault for being wrong about Edwin Diaz, I will gladly do so. And I think I have. I was dead wrong about Edwin Diaz. I didn't think he could pitch in New York. I didn't think he could handle it. And I thought that this was going to be a disaster. I thought it was, I wouldn't even say Armando Benitez 2.0 because Armando Benitez was good during regular seasons. I thought 2019 was so bad. And here's why, Howard, I'm not to defend myself because I am taking a loss. Like I did not think this would happen. I was wrong. But I'll walk you through why I thought that. He got off to a good start. You guys remember this? In April, in May, Edwin Diaz was awesome. And he came in for a 4 or 5 out save. And I think it was against the Tigers for some reason. I could be wrong about this. This is off the top of my head. And he blew the game. And it didn't seem like the end of the world. I mean, they asked him to do a lot, 4 or 5 out save. Mickey Callaway was asking a lot. And it seemed like it turned his season on a head. And he just really started to struggle. And he lost his closer's job. And he had so many just bad, bad blown saves. And they started piling up. And the way they piled up and the fact that he did get off to a good start made me think that it just became mental for him. And even in 2020, I didn't think in that abbreviated season he was that good. Same thing with 2021. Like, he was better than 2019. Thankfully, it was one of the worst years you'll ever have from a closer. But I didn't believe in him. I raised my hand. And I don't know if it was just misreading the season that he had. Howard likes to say, hey, if you look at the underlying numbers, he wasn't that bad. Okay. I didn't believe it. So I guess what I'm confused about is what the hell are you disappointed in me for? I'm admitting it. I mean, I gladly admit it. I was very wrong about him. And he has shown not just obviously the electric stuff, which is obvious, but he shows poise so that when he isn't a bases loaded, nobody out jam, and things are going haywire, he still can get out of it. And what I'll say about Edwin Diaz is, will he have a horrible blown save in the playoffs? May happen. I can't guarantee it won't. But I'm not concerned that he's going to melt in the moment. He has proven time in and time out that even when it looks like he's going to melt in a moment, like he did against the Phillies in game 4 last year, and he walks the first two guys, he finds ways. And he has a lot of guts. So hopefully that was enough of me admitting I'm wrong about 2019 Edwin Diaz. I've not shied away from that. Was I too harsh on him? It's easy to say that now. The guy's been great. And I do trust him. Now, these 4 games against the Phillies. Would we take a split? Like, is a split enough? They've owned the Philadelphia Phillies all year. They did lose 2 out of 3 in Philadelphia. That was in the midst of all that losing that they had in late June. I kind of wrestle between, would I accept it or not accept it? I mean, the Phillies are throwing out a lot of tough starting pitchers. It looks like they may be without Trey Turner. He suffered a hamstring injury late in Sunday's game. I think what's really important is just win series. So if you split against the Phillies, win the Texas series, win the San Diego series, if you win all your series, that should be enough to hold off Arizona, San Francisco, St. Louis, Cincinnati, all the teams that are basically chirping at the Mets' feet. Now, as far as this week is concerned, it is a four-game series, so we will probably split the baby and do a midweek Rico Bronya in the midst of this Philly series. And, of course, instant reactions whenever they're warranted. We do appreciate your feedback. TheRicoB@gmail.com. TheRicoB@gmail.com. If you've missed any episode of the Rico Bronya, go back into the archives. Like, if you're wondering how come you didn't talk a lot about the Edwin Diaz game from Friday, that'd be episode 543. Download it, listen to it, and yell at your phone as much as you'd like. Thank you very much for listening and hanging out with us on another edition of Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.